When you drive a vehicle so reliable it's backed by a 10-year, 100,000-mile limited warranty, you stop thinking about what you can't do and start doing what you never thought possible. Visit your local Kia dealer today to see what you're capable of in a vehicle that inspires confidence around every corner. Kia. Movement that inspires.
Call 800-333-4KIA for details. Always drive safely. Limited inventory available. Warranties include 10-year, 100,000-mile powertrain and 5-year, 60,000-mile basic. Warranties are limited. See retailer for details.
This is your moment. Your moment to move forward and make progress. It's time to see where an education can take you. For over 130 years, Strayer University has been at the forefront of change, offering programs that help students like you get ahead and stay ahead, so you can keep striving. Visit strayer.edu to learn more. Strayer University is certified to operate in Virginia by CHEV.
News, science, the unexplained, space and the cosmos, exploring our past, our future, and the mysteries of our universe. Taking a critical look at reality and a journey to the edges of human understanding. The future is now. This is Micah Hanks.
From my bunker deep in the heart of South America, and of course broadcasting all around the globe via podcasting apps everywhere, and of course our station affiliates like the UnX Network, I'm your host, Micah Hanks. It is the Micah Hanks Program. Glad, as always, to be getting into gear and going in pursuit of the enigmatic yet again, as we do every week. So let's dive right in. Hope you guys are all doing great out there. In addition to space news, an icon, albeit a controversial one, in ufology has passed away. And as usual, I have plenty to say about that. And we also, of course, have news about why some think there may be lost civilizations out there, some yet to have been found, but that have remained hidden for many, many thousands of years. We'll get into that and much more, but of course the main focus this week, in keeping with that idea, has to do with one of my very favorite topics, and that is anomalous archaeology. We'll be looking at claims of high technology that emanate from the ancient world, and much more. Indeed, we got quite a show lined up for you this week. Hope you guys are all doing fantastic out there, by the way, and that the weather is nice wherever you may be, as many of my kindred back in the States are easing into spring. And when I say easing, I mean taking their sweet time. Talking to dear old mom and dad back in North Carolina yesterday, they were saying, you know, here it is, it's April, and it still feels like winter. Well, I got news for you. Down here on the southern continent where I am, it's supposed to be fall, and after several days of cool, well, you know, autumn temperatures, it's 80 degrees again today, feeling like summer all over again. You know, our friend Bryce Zabel, who was on the program with us the other day, sent me an email over the weekend asking, you still in Brazil? How are you? You know, he and I are working on some fun things, and indeed, Bryce, if you hear this, I am still down here. I'll be here at least for a few more weeks, but I am looking forward to getting back to spring in the mountains and eventually getting back on the road, not only to perform, as I often do as a musician, on those summer nights in the Carolinas, but I've got a lot of conferences I'm going to be attending this summer as well. One out in Utah, one a little later in the summer out in the Midwest, and although I'm speaking at those, there are a few others I intend to attend, and so I'll try to have a complete listing of all those events where you might be able to run into yours truly in the weeks and months ahead. I'll be sure and update that. You know, I mean, after COVID-19, there's been no point in updating the events page over there at MicahHanks.com, so it's certainly good to be getting back into the swing of things. And in addition to heading out there to conferences, to also getting back into some sort of sense of normalcy. Although things have certainly been anything but normal for folks on the International Space Station in recent days. As had been speculated and now apparently has been confirmed, The Guardian reports that Russia plans to halt its cooperation over the International Space Station, with the director of the space agency Roscosmos saying that partnership will be restored only when illegal sanctions, he says, are removed. Russia says it will end cooperation with Western countries over the International Space Station until these sanctions are lifted. Meanwhile, U.S. President Joe Biden saying this morning that more sanctions are on the way, in light of images that circulated online over the weekend and, of course, which were all over the news cycle this morning. Heartbreaking images, in fact, of what are believed to be Ukrainian civilians who were killed. And now few leaders in the Western world, Joe Biden or anybody else, seem to be pulling any punches in terms of, well, the terms they're using. And it's sad, folks, I've got to tell you. Nobody wants to wake up and start their show prep and be reading headlines that include words like genocide or war crimes. You know, on the Middle Theory podcast, as always, I'll have more to say about the current news that's happening. But for those of you who are listeners, you'll already know this. The rest of you, I do want to bring to your attention that I syndicate a link, just like we did throughout the duration of the pandemic with coronavirus charities. I also syndicate in the show notes on every episode of the Middle Theory podcast that I produce each week, a link where you can find numerous charities that PayPal has set up for the people of Ukraine. You don't have to have a PayPal account to donate. You can just use a credit or a debit card. But I do ask people, please consider any kind of donation you can make to help the people of Ukraine right now. They certainly need it badly, and we can all play a part. Please consider doing so. In other news, as I mentioned at the outset, something of an icon in ufology has passed away. Certainly someone who was familiar to listeners of late night radio, and also a fellow who was rather controversial at times, and that is the late researcher John Lear. Our friend of the program, Greg Bishop, had the following to say about John Lear's passing in a write-up he did over at coasttocoastam.com, and I want to quote a little of what Greg had to say, then I'll offer some perspectives of my own. But he notes, Coast to Coast AM is saddened to share the news that the legendary aviator, UFO researcher, and longtime guest of the program, John Lear, has passed away at the age of 79. The son of famed Lear jet inventor William Lear, he grew up surrounded by aircraft and pilots. In 1966, at the age of 23, Lear was the lead aviator on a record-breaking flight around the world. Lear also flew missions for Continental Air Services, Inc., to provide airlift support during the Vietnam War. He was licensed to pilot almost anything that flew and achieved thousands of hours as pilot in command. Now, as Greg correctly points out, John Lear was quite the decorated pilot. In fact, maybe one of the most decorated pilots living, prior to his death, of course. Greg goes on to mention he was best known by Coast to Coast listeners for his stories and revelations about UFOs and aliens. He appeared with George Knapp, George Norrie, and Art Bell numerous times to reveal information about apparent government cooperation with alien races, and was one of the original researchers into the strange goings-on at Area 51, as well as other secret locations, using what he claimed was official insider information to support his assertions. More on some of those assertions in a moment, but skipping ahead a bit here. As Greg writes, in 1987, Lear released a statement that the U.S. government had entered into a secret agreement with aliens and was promoting the gradual public release of this information through popular media. He apparently became aware of a supposed ET presence on Earth and their deals with officialdom through his contact with UFO researcher Paul Banowitz in the 1980s. Now, of course, listeners of this program will remember that Greg came on the program recently and we talked about Paul Banowitz because Greg wrote the most authoritative account of how Mr. Banowitz was misled by a special agent with the Air Force Office of Special Investigations into believing a lot of conspiracy theories about alleged alien contacting government. No, the information he was supplied wasn't accurate. It was, in fact, in an attempt to cover up some projects that the NSA had going on at Kirtland Air Force Base, as many of you will remember. But nonetheless, Paul Banowitz was a respected UFO researcher who unfortunately, gradually over time, in part perhaps due to exploitation of his interest in UFOs by the Air Force, began to experience worsening mental health, was eventually hospitalized. And the strange situation with Banowitz was incredibly influential in ufology for many decades. Case in point, it had been through his associations with Banowitz that Lear first began to catch wind of the idea that the U.S. government not only knew more about UFOs and aliens than it was letting on, but that it actually struck deals with them. And in some circles, this is known as the so-called dark hypothesis. If you ever find a copy of Jerome Clark's excellent UFO encyclopedia, there's an entry in that encyclopedia for the dark hypothesis that has been proposed by John Lear over the years. And we actually did an entire episode for X subscribers a while back that was all about that. In essence, going all the way back to the days of Dwight Eisenhower, there has been this supposition presented in UFO circles for decades that the U.S. government not only is aware of UFOs and knows exactly what they are, where they're from, but in fact they have struck these devil's dealings with the aliens, which allow for things like experimentation, abductions, all this sort of stuff. Has there ever really been any evidence that supports that? No. In fact, it would really seem difficult to understand why the U.S. government is producing all of this information about UAP in recent days, and further, why they appear to be establishing new investigative bodies to look into this problem, if in fact they actually knew what was going on. Well, you see, Michael, what you're missing here is that's part of the smokescreen, right? They're establishing the AOI-MSG and the UAP task force and all this in order to mislead the public. This is only the latest in a long string of disinformation campaigns, just like what happened to Mr. Paul Benowitz when Special Agent Rick Doty gave him bogus documents and led him to believe that an alien invasion was imminent and drove the poor guy nuts. And of course, for those who would like the definitive account on that, I mentioned Greg Bishop's book, Project Beta. Also check out my friend Mark Pilkington's book, Mirage Men, and there's a film of the same name which kind of chronicles this story as well, but on the silver screen. And one of the reasons that there's been so much said about that particular period in ufology and these players and the controversy surrounding them, one of the reasons there's been so much said about that over the years, I think, is because of the way that this influenced the entire field of research. Rather paradoxically to me, on the one hand, you have people who believe the misinformation that was fed to them, like Paul Benowitz did. He was convinced not only that UFOs represented alien intelligence as visiting Earth, but in fact, that the government knew about it, that they were in cahoots with them, and that they were allowing things to happen that shouldn't be happening. This infringes on our rights and our freedoms as individuals, and in fact, actually, it may endanger humanity as we know it. And these sorts of ideas were propagated in part by guys like John Lear back in the 1990s amidst the controversy surrounding cases like the Roswell UFO incident, as well as the bogus MJ-12 documents, which, again, are still one of the more talked about aspects of the history of ufology. Now, on account of his rather fantastic beliefs, I always was a little wary of John Lear myself. Although I do recall back in my days in radio, a friend who interviewed him. And when Lear came on the program, I mean, he sounded like a shell of a man. In fact, I'd call it one of the saddest interviews I'd ever heard. Because Lear essentially comes on there and just says, look, you know, the alien reality is what it is. I've been trying to warn people for decades. And really all I can tell you now is just love your family. You know, be good to your friends and neighbors. That's about all you can do. I mean, he sounded almost like a guy who had just given up. There's no reason for us to try any longer because this is the reality in which we live. And one has to wonder, the older he got, did he continue to believe these things? With the current revelations coming out of government and all of the ongoing dialogue about this, I mean, I wonder what John Lear thought about this. Did he think that the government all of a sudden coming out and being more open about its UFO investigations, or UAP as it prefers to call it these days, that this was actually disinformation? What about the disinformation that actually informed Paul Benowitz, who helped John Lear actually get into the ufological game, so to speak? But in addition to all of that, one of the interesting paradoxes to me about all of this is that some of the ones who are the quickest to call conspiracy theory these days and look at current events regarding UAP and government interest in it and say, I don't buy it, I don't believe in the government, I don't trust them, this is all just a misdirection campaign of some kind. These things belong to them or they belong to somebody else, but the last thing they are what the government says, which is unidentified craft of any kind. Yeah, some of the ones who are crying conspiracy right now about current developments regarding UAP and government are the very ones who are resistant to the idea that UFOs represent anything extraterrestrial. Meanwhile, decades ago, the ones who were the staunchest proponents of an alien presence on Earth were actually the targets of misinformation campaigns. And in fact, some of the precedent for people's distrust of the government when it comes to the idea of UFOs and anything that officialdom has to say about that subject actually stems from that period, when thanks to the folks at the NSA and the Air Force Office of Special Investigations, fellas like Paul Benowitz and, yes, the late John Lear, were sort of helped to cultivate a belief system that has influenced ufology for decades. But another interesting byproduct of all this, to me at least, has to do with the fact that on the one hand there are those who say that the U.S. government is behind everything that we believe to be UFOs, and then there are those who say the government is hiding the alien reality and they're covering up all the information about where the UFOs come from. Conspiracy theorists, in other words, exist on both sides of that fence. And so indeed, in terms of the cultural commentary surrounding the UFO topic now for the last several decades, John Lear, to me, was always someone who was strangely influential and always a bit controversial in all of that. But as Greg Bishop notes in the post that he wrote there for the Coast to Coast AM website, Lear will be fondly remembered by countless Coast listeners who are captivated by his riveting appearances on the program, as well as the UFO research community, which celebrates his significant contributions to the field, his daring declarations about the nature of a government cover-up, and the many friendships he made with an array of investigators over the years. He is survived by two daughters and his former wife, Marcel Tagand Lear. Now, shifting gears just a bit here for a moment, I also want to touch on an interesting news story that caught my attention this week, which has a little more to do with what the main focus of our discussion this week will be. Candida Moss, writing for the Daily Beast, recently had Atlantis on her mind, and speaking with Daniel Parsons, a professor in sedimentology, writes the following over there at the Beast. As she tells us, Daniel Parsons had been on a family beach trip when he first heard about what we might call a modern version of Atlantis. As she writes, in the 14th century, a small port near Holderness, England, vanished into the sea. The town, Ravenseraad, very interesting name, had been ravaged by two floods. The first overwhelmed the town's abbey, leaving the streets full of human remains. The second, according to eyewitnesses, caused a towering wall of water to surround the village and swallow it. The residents fled, and Ravenseraad was never heard of again. Now, scientists from the University of Hull have a plan to uncover it, which, by the way, they now give the intriguing title of Yorkshire's Atlantis. Now, this is somewhat in keeping with the idea that I've talked about in recent days on the program, the idea that there are submerged archaeological sites all along the coasts, really all around the world. And some of these date back to very, very, very long ago. In fact, during the last ice age, I would argue some of the most compelling archaeological sites that will really give us an idea about who was going where and when migrations really began into the Americas, yeah, those are probably all underwater. And as my geologist friend with the Seven Ages Research Associates, James Waldo, recently said, one day, if we ever go into another ice age and sea levels go back down, he says it's going to be a real field day for archaeologists. But as Moss writes in her article here, Daniel Parsons, the sedimentologist, first heard about Yorkshire's Atlantis while he was on a family beach trip. And he recently told The Guardian that while talking to historian Phil Matheson, he learned that local fishermen scouting for lobsters had seen disturbances on the surface of the water at low tide. This initial conversation sparked Parsons' interest in the sunken town and its location. As a geoscientist, he was just the person to try and find it. And how would he do this? By using high-resolution sonar systems to try and locate a sunken town. Now granted, Yorkshire's Atlantis, being a town that fell away into the sea, is a far cry from an entire sunken continent, right? And again, I have my personal doubts about whether there really was an Atlantis, like Plato wrote about. We've covered this subject plenty in the past. But, nonetheless, I am compelled by how many different cultures around the world tell stories about an ancient lost continent, mysterious islands that vanished in the Atlantic Ocean long ago, people from different cultures who claim to have actually come from across the Atlantic Ocean in prehistoric times. Indeed, none of this may necessarily mean that there was actually a continent out there in the middle of the ocean. But then again, the Azores are right there in the middle of the Atlantic, an island chain part of the Mid-Atlantic Ridge that, again, back during the Pleistocene when sea levels were lower, absolutely would have been more exposed, and some have made compelling arguments that there, in fact, could have been more land exposed at that time, and that although it might not have exactly been a continent, the island chain we know as the Azores today, as seen by people maybe 12 or 13,000 years ago, indeed might have looked a whole lot more like the island continent that Plato wrote about. And indeed, Atlantis may not have been like Plato described. It may not have been a high civilization. They might not have actually fought wars with the Greeks. But there very well may have been a landmass that gave rise to legends, stories of which have trickled down to us over the ages, and which have continued to capture our imaginations well into the present day. Now, while the idea of lost continents may remain in the realm of myth and conjecture and speculation. One thing you don't have to speculate about is how quickly and easily you can lose a grip on your health. That's the kind of thing you've got to maintain. You've got to work hard at that. That's why I exercise every day. And there's one more thing that I also incorporate into my daily routine, which by now you have no doubt heard me talk about in the past. And yes, that is Athletic Greens. Look, if you want a great tasting vitamin supplement, something that's going to give you more energy every day, that's going to improve your gut health, and it's also going to optimize your immune system, you don't have to rely on taking bizarre regimens of pills or spending money that, let's be honest, you don't actually have in order to be able to do so. Because Athletic Greens takes some of the very best all-natural vitamins, minerals, and supplements and combines them into a simple daily dose that you just add to a glass of water, you stir, you drink, and you go, like I do every morning. And let me tell you, it has been a game changer for me. And that's one of the reasons I'm so passionate about telling you guys why you should try it too. With Athletic Greens, you not only have a great tasting and easy way to incorporate vitamins and minerals into your lifestyle, but it also works for virtually everybody and all different kinds of lifestyles and diets, whether you're gluten-free, dairy-free, vegan, paleo, keto. Athletic Greens is going to be a great complement for any of those kinds of diets. But one thing I really love about Athletic Greens is that when I started taking it, within a week I began to notice I was sleeping better at night. And part of the reason for that is if you like to exercise like I do, Athletic Greens is going to help your body recover. And in doing so, it helps you sleep at night. Simply put, Athletic Greens uses the best products based on the latest science and constant testing to make sure that you are getting the all-in-one nutritional insurance that your body needs. Plus, don't forget that Athletic Greens is a climate-neutral certified company, and they also support charities like No Kid Hungry in the United States. Now listen, right now, guys, it is time to reclaim your health and be sure that you arm your immune system with the convenient daily nutrition that it needs, especially when you're heading into the cold and the flu season. Remember, it's just one scoop and a cup of water, and then you're good to go. That's it. No need for a million different pills and supplements to look out for your health. To make it easy, Athletic Greens is going to give you a free one-year supply of immune-supporting vitamin D, and don't forget about those five free travel packs with your first purchase. And all you've got to do to start getting those benefits is to head over to athleticgreens.com/Micah. Again, that's athleticgreens.com/MICAH, my name, athleticgreens.com/Micah, to take ownership over your health and pick up the ultimate daily nutritional insurance. Trust me, you're going to love it just as much as I do. All right, and with all the news now out of the way, it's time for us to turn our attention in the direction of another favorite of mine, a subject which we revisit often here on the program, and that involves the mysteries of the ancient past and those collectors of odd bits of history that help build a picture of a past far more mysterious than many would acknowledge. Anomalous archaeology is going to be on the table when we return right here on the Micah Hanks Program. Welcome back. It is the Micah Hanks Program, always with a mind for the ancient world and the many mysteries and relics that have been afforded us by those who inhabited it. You know, I've noticed over the last few months, every now and then we, of course, try to get a good archaeology-themed episode in here on the main show. One reason, of course, being that the download numbers show that it's obviously a very popular topic. Even despite all the interest in the UAP subject these days, and make no mistake, We cover that one a lot, not only because of all the developments happening and, of course, the public interest, but I've followed that subject professionally for more than a decade and, of course, prior to my professional interest, going even further back. And so UAP, or UFOs, have always been a cornerstone of this program. But, of course, so are the mysteries of the ancient past, and that's one reason why the Seven Ages Audio Journal exists. But, of course, Jason and James, my co-hosts, and I are very passionate about archaeology as a science, and therefore we primarily speak with archaeologists on that show. And we don't look at the fringes of that subject so much as to showcase the mysteries of the past that actual scientists are looking at. I think that's really important, considering the amount of fringe archaeology and pseudoscience that prevails, especially online. It is important to offer an academically informed perspective, and how better to do that than to talk with academics? But when you look at topics like UAP, the problem is that while there are some academics that get involved, many have long shunned the topic. They've been too concerned about what it would do to their careers if they engage with this topic, and therefore they have avoided it. But when academics and professionals avoid an area of inquiry that might otherwise actually yield some results if science were to look at it, the inevitable problem that arises is that the research is left to the amateurs, and then the cycle continues, because the professionals, the academics, then look at all the amateurs getting involved and say, well, I don't want to associate with all of those people and their rampant speculations and pseudoscience. That's not going to do my field any good. And therefore, another result of this dynamic is that when professionals who won't get involved, and then it's left to the amateurs, but then they become even more likely to keep their distance. When they actually do engage with a controversial topic, what ends up happening more often than not is the qualified academics devote their time to debunking the speculations and the theories of the amateurs rather than actually looking at the phenomenon. And in my opinion, that's actually a very noble, a very justified thing to do. But I don't think that it's always necessarily justifiable to say that because amateurs are the one who are leading the discussion about a certain topic, that therefore that topic is not worthy of actual scientific attention, apart from active debunking and skeptical critiquing. You know, it very well may be, for instance, in the case of UAP, that there actually is a phenomenon, but that the amateurs who have been studying it have gotten maybe a part or maybe most of their speculations about it all wrong. All the more reason I would say that we need scientists looking at it. But of course, up until fairly recently, most scientists would have nothing to do with a topic that they felt was unworthy of scientific attention. Now, when it comes to archaeology, of course, on the Seven Ages Audio Journal, the guys and I always endeavor to talk with qualified professional archaeologists about authentic archaeology. But, as with any field, a few things I learned very quickly when I became more involved with archaeology and the archaeological community was that there's as much infighting in that field as any field that exists. Probably more so, in fact. There are every bit as many of the warring factions, the divided groups, you know, the contests of wit, the battles, the flame wars. It's no different from any other field. And, just like about any other field, any other academic discipline, there are those areas where most of the scientists won't go. And yet, which also may involve phenomena, observations, data, that is worthy of scientific attention, but it doesn't receive any. Here again, because of controversies that may ensue. And so, when we talk about archaeology on this podcast, often I try to touch on those areas. The speculations about things like, well, how old is civilization? How old do some of these relics from antiquity actually go back? When we look at myths and traditional beliefs from various cultures around the world, and sometimes we find references to things like what seem to our modern minds, like references to anachronistic, advanced technology, but in an era when it couldn't possibly have existed. You know, when we find these kinds of things, I'm very interested in them. And although I understand and respect why many academics don't go there, it doesn't necessarily mean that no one should. And because of that, I've told the guys on the Seven Ages Audio Journal that, you know, as much as I love that side of academic archaeology, there are other areas of archaeology and history, and perhaps also burgeoning areas of scientific inquiry. Those may involve UAP studies, those may involve cryptozoology, those may involve what some would call anomalous archaeology, like we'll be discussing today. I think it's very important that somebody put time, effort, and energy into trying to apply logical, scientifically informed studies in those areas, where, frankly, the academics often do not. And again, I can't blame them for wanting to remain out of those controversies, but unlike them, I am not a qualified academic. I'm not a tenured professor. I'm not somebody who risks his professional reputation when I engage these topics. And so I do it far more frequently than my academic kindred do. But make no mistake, I get the emails from them every week. Some who, sadly, express their desire at times to leave academia because they feel that the kinds of stigmas I'm describing right now actually limit scientific advancement. I have had recent exchanges with many academics who have just complained that being peer-reviewed only means you're kind of part of a club. It should mean, of course, that there are qualified scientists who are reviewing your work and helping to ensure a level of quality control for what gets published in academic journals. But unfortunately, what happens instead is it becomes kind of this, well, if this person's work gets reviewed and is published, they're part of the club. But once you are a part of that peer review club, the lines are drawn in the sand, and if you step outside those lines, your membership can and often will be revoked. Now, that's certainly not the case with all academic publications. I don't want to paint anything with a broad brush. But it makes the position that I try to occupy, that of the scientifically informed anomalist, a fairly precarious position. I'll be talking about science one day, and then the next day I'll be talking about something that many would relegate to the annals of myth and folklore, if not outright absurdity. But when we look back in time, we see so many instances where things that once seemed crazy or unlikely later were scientifically verified. A great example is one that's been offered in the past by my friend Dr. Thomas Glass, and that involves the notion that within the last 200 years, there was a time when people would have laughed at you if you told them that washing your hands could prevent the spread of disease. Within the last 200 years, to cite another example, men of science would have laughed at you if you told them that stones fell from the sky. Impossible, right? Not just impossible, that's absurd. And yet, of course, today we know all about germs, don't we? We know all about meteorites. Those are examples from within just the last couple of centuries, and when we go even further back, men who professed to be of the cross and to be upholders of humankind's spirituality would have burned you at the stake for saying that the sun didn't revolve around the earth and that it was the other way around. Don't forget, they actually did that. That was actually done to many scientists who were among the leading thinkers of their era. Sadly, they weren't recognized as such in their day. This only came to pass much later. Well after their time, well after their death in the war of ideas. And one has to ask themselves how many more instances throughout time, going forward, from the present day into the future, how many more times are we going to fool ourselves into disbelieving when there is ample evidence of scientific phenomena well worthy of study and attention right here in our midst? This, of course, is why, on this program, I put my name, Micah Hanks, behind the study of the anomalous. And fortunately, I'm not the only person who's ever done so. We're going to get into some discussion about anomalous archaeology here in a moment. But before we do, I want to pay a bit of respect to one of the late great anomalists of our time, and arguably one of my favorites. That's the late American physicist William R. Corliss. Corliss had been a fan of the peculiar writings, ramblings at times actually, of Charles Hoy Fort, author of books like The Book of the Damned and The Man from Whom We Get the Name Fortean when we refer to strange phenomena. Now, Corliss, of course, was best known in science circles for his books on physics, computers, rockets, I mean, he was a very prolific author in a variety of different areas of science, spacefaring, and technology. But Corliss was also one of those library lurkers who maintained an unrepentant interest in the anomalous. And so he began to collect little odd bits of history and little footnotes and peculiarities of science. And he began to catalog these probably back in the 1970s, starting with the field of archaeology. And no doubt, part of that interest was driven by the prevalence of discussion around that time that stemmed from the speculations presented in books like Chariots of the Gods by Eric von Daniken. You had all kinds of other authors, Zachariah Sitchin, Emanuel Velikovsky, plenty of others, who presented their own alternative take on human history. Well, Corliss was interested in all this. He didn't always agree with those authors and their speculations, but the subjects certainly fascinated him. And so Corliss started spending a lot of his spare time in libraries doing research. And that research, which would eventually lead to an entire catalog, dozens of books, documenting various areas of science and anomalous phenomena contained within those branches of science. Yes, it eventually led to what's known today as the Sourcebook Project, and this is a fascinating catalog devoted to the study of scientific anomalies, but the very first humble offering remains one of my favorites. It's titled Strange Artifacts, and it was written in 1974. In the preface to that, Corliss writes, "I've always been intrigued with the tailings from the mine of science. I mean those facts that do not fit the mold, those anomalies that should not exist, those sports, those wild points that lie far off the curve. One of my hobbies is collecting and organizing these homeless facts. These waifs are curious and most intriguing. Either they are false, or science still has much fundamental work to do. But I leave such problems to the reader. All I have done is collect, categorize, and reprint this anomalous information. The result is this first volume of archaeological curiosities. Perhaps, Corliss says, you can make something out of them. At the very least, I hope you will be excited by the unknown territory that still lies ahead of us." As he later goes on to note, some of the material included here will be labeled pseudoscience, but some of the data so castigated will be legitimate science a decade hence. The antiquity of man is, of course, a case in point. The reader should bear in mind that many items are inserted with the express purpose of rocking the boat. Something I also appreciate about Corliss's approach, of course, had been that, as he wrote, "I should also add that I have deliberately introduced data, perhaps 25% of the whole, from outside the scientific literature. This was not done because of any lack of material, but rather to ensure the widest possible spectrum of observations." Well, needless to say, over the years, I have spent a lot of time both on this program and on other shows that I produce, and some that I've guested upon, talking about William R. Corliss. I've written about him in articles. I always try to bring attention to his work. And one of the main reasons is because it's rare these days to find someone who has that kind of thirst for real science and who, as a result, can therefore temper some of his desires when it comes to his pursuit of the anomalous. He can study it, he can look at it objectively without ruling things out of hand or drawing premature conclusions. Indeed, I think Corliss was spot on. There is much to be said about the scientific world, much to be discovered, a few anomalies that indeed may one day be resolved and prove to be bits and pieces of the broader picture that we have of science and the workings of the universe. But it's difficult to make those kinds of discoveries if you're only willing to work within your own comfortable little paradigm. So let's shift the paradigm a little this week, shall we? When we return, the long controversial idea of high technology that existed in the ancient world will be on the table as we go in pursuit of anomalous archaeology this week on the Micah Hanks Program.
Thank you.
When most of us think of wearable technology, we think of devices that have only been made in the last few decades, maybe just the last few years. Of course, watches and other technologies that can be worn have existed for quite a while. But looking further back in history, from time to time, a few surprises do turn up. In fact, what if I told you 300 years ago, there had been a calculator so small it could be fitted to a ring? This actually existed in the Qing Dynasty era, which took place between 1644 and 1911. It is thought the object in question had been created by a famous mathematician by the name of Cheng Dawei, and the device he is believed to have created is known as the Zuxuan Abacus. It's made of pure silver, and it's just 1.2 centimeters long, less than a centimeter wide. And yet, it's a fully functioning abacus that can fit on a ring. 300-year-old wearable technology. According to Interesting Engineering, the beads of the abacus ring are very small with a diameter of less than 1 millimeter. The beads move smoothly along the silver rods, and in fact would have been too small to have been moved with one's fingers. And in fact, one speculation is that the wearer of this abacus ring may have been a female, since the average woman's hairpin could have easily moved the beads on the abacus. Such historical anachronisms as this, and of course the even more famous Antikythera mechanism of ancient Greece, have long fascinated archaeologists and haunted the minds of antiquarians over the ages who have gone in pursuit of the mysteries of the human past. And make no mistake, there are indeed plenty. Of course, William R. Corliss, as mentioned in the last segment, was one of these many purveyors of the damned facts, the homeless little bits of knowledge that have often peppered science journals and publications throughout the centuries. One of my very favorite publications of the late Mr. Corliss had been his catalog on small artifacts, not unlike the ring-sized abacus of the Qing Dynasty. Although many of the small artifacts that Corliss would spend so much of his time focusing on might not seem very anomalous at first glance. A good example includes the so-called high tech of what is known as Maya Blue. I'll quote from Corliss's entry on this here, where he notes, "Humans have been painting cave walls and pottery for tens of thousands of years. And of course, anyone who has ever spent a time in a museum or in a history book will be aware that occasionally striking shades of blue accompany that ancient art. But as Corliss goes on to tell us, even jaded archaeologists have been astonished at the dazzling blue paint the Maya applied to their murals and ceramics. Unlike the blue paints employed elsewhere in the world a millennium ago," he tells us, "Maya blue is more brilliant and, more significantly, does not fade like other blues based upon the indigo plant. Even after 15 centuries, Maya blue still maintains its vivid brilliancy." So what? Some of you may be thinking. Okay, so the Mayan artists were really selective about the kind of paint they used. Naturally, they wanted to use hues that would maintain their color over time. Where's the mystery there? Well, as Corliss goes on to point out, somehow the Maya paint chemists were able to combine indigo molecules with needles of palygorskite clay to create a chemical cage-like structure that protected the enclosed indigo particles from fading. But wait, it gets better. Then by adding nanoparticles of metal, they made the paint more brilliant. Corliss gives us the following quote from M. Jose Yacaman, who remarked in technical terms the following, quote, "The combination of an intercalated clay forming a superlattice and the metallic and oxide nanoparticles supported on an amorphous substrate makes the ancient Maya blue look like modern nanostructured materials." In other words, that paint, which archaeologists recognize as Maya blue, isn't just vivid. We might actually recognize this as a form of nanotechnology from the ancient world, about which Mr. Corliss tells us we have to suppose that this precocious chemistry was hit upon by accident, after many fruitless trials. Many fruitless trials indeed. Probably took about as long as it did for those ancient shaman who managed to figure out that combining Banisteriopsis capi, that is, the liana vine that grows throughout parts of South America, with other different plants rich in the chemical compound DMT, but mind you, that compound remains inactive in those plants when taken orally, unless, of course, combined with Banisteriopsis capi, brewed in a pot for hours and hours, and then drank as a foul-tasting tea, and which thereafter elicits powerful visionary experiences. Yeah, figuring out the chemistry behind Mayan blue probably took as long, at least, as figuring out the correct recipe behind the chemical concoction we know of today as ayahuasca. My point is, yes, of course, over thousands and thousands of years, and lots of trial and error, sure, these things could have been discovered by chance, but one has to wonder if it's always just chance alone. Then we have archaeological evidence of grape seeds that tell us that while grapes were consumed and probably pressed in their juice at least 8,000 years ago, that part isn't surprising. Neither is, according to Corliss, the likelihood that some of that Paleolithic grape juice was left alone for a few days, and therefore might have fermented naturally into wine. Unfortunately, he tells us, in the Middle East, the high temperatures quickly turned the wine into vinegar. But as early as 5,400 BC, our ancestral enophiles, that is, lovers of wine, learned, and we don't know how, that their valued wine could be preserved much longer by adding a resin to it. And that's exactly what they seem to have done, because chemical analysis of Iranian pottery of the period from about 4,500 to 5,000 BC, keep in mind, more than 7,000 years ago, turned up traces of resin from the pistachia tree. This, along with stoppers used to enclose the wine containers, helped with the preservation. Question: how in the world did they figure that out? But if you think that the preservation of wine or the vivid coloration of Mayan paint pigments is impressive, wait until I tell you what the ancient Mesopotamians were doing. Because despite the absence of basalt quarries, basalt of course being a stone that was frequently used in the construction of megalithic monuments and other ancient structures, since the Mesopotamians didn't have any handy, they decided maybe they could build some of their own. That's right, I mean they appear to have made their own stone. As Corliss explains, they were able to make a lot of things from pottery, but when it came to grinding grain and engineering structures, they needed something harder and stronger. And so what did the ancient Mesopotamians do? They created artificial basalt made from silt. How did they do it? Well, it was actually fairly simple. They melted silt and let it cool slowly. Now here we have a great example of what I'm talking about. The ancient Mesopotamians would melt silt and then let it cool very slowly, and this would produce a sort of artificial basalt that they could use in building structures. What's so mysterious about that, right? If people can figure out how to fire clay, if ancient humans could learn processes like smelting and all sorts of other things, surely they could figure out that they could melt silt and then let it cool, and they could use that as a hard form of stone, artificial though it is, for construction purposes. But the devil is in the details. We have to think a little more deeply about this seemingly simple process, because as Corliss points out, three remarkable intellectual and technical advances were required in advance of it. They are as follows. 1. The Mesopotamians first had to recognize that silt could be melted. This could not have been obvious in 1000 BC. Next, they had to develop high temperature, at least 1200 degrees Celsius, smelters that were much larger than those they were using for metallurgical purposes. And then 3, finally they had to discover that slow cooling was needed for the growth of large crystals in the cooling melt. Of course they had no microscopes, so they couldn't see the crystals. It had to have been something learned, yet again, from experience. And one does have to wonder, though it's not impossible, that all this could have been achieved through simple trial and error. We do get to a point where we have to imagine that it certainly took a very long time. That, or perhaps, some of the ancient minds involved in this process perhaps had a little more technology on hand than we suspect. As Corliss writes, that the Mesopotamians were able to synthesize basalt can be seen at Makshan Shapir. Slabs of this artificial rock, flat and smooth on some sides from the molds, are abundant. In fact, some 100 cubic meters of the man-made stone have been found. Now, what Corliss describes here is well known. It is indeed recognized as scientific fact, and it can also be replicated today. But this notion that we're describing here, process is remarkably similar to what Corliss describes involving the creation of synthetic stone in the ancient world, has led to tremendous controversy in recent years. And as we're about to hear when we come back here in a moment, some chemists believe that this may actually even offer clues to how the pyramids were built. We'll delve into that and much more when we return right here on the Micah Hanks Program. Welcome back. It is the Micah Hanks Program, exploring one of my favorite topics. This week, anomalous archaeology. Indeed, many mysteries of the ancient past, which remain to this day, if one knows where to look. We are looking at a few of those this week, but of course, I must remind you, if you aren't already a subscriber, you're only getting half of the story, part of the conversation. And so head on over to MicahHanks.com/podcast. Up there in the upper right-hand corner of the page, you will see the X memberships link. And of course, we always have that syndicated in the show notes with every episode. Don't forget, of course, X subscribers, that you have your own unique RSS feed. You can submit that to your favorite podcasting app, and you can listen to your shows, all the shows that you get as a subscriber, right there through your favorite podcasting app. No need to log in, although many people enjoy doing that and getting their show notes that way. However you prefer to access your content, there's always a little something for everybody. And don't forget, it's not just a weekly additional podcast. There are also the monthly specials known as Enigmas that we feature. Gosh, going on 90 episodes of those in the back catalog for subscribers. And so for those of you who have only recently signed up and are making your way down into the bunkering, you see the Lost Hall of Records. That is the back catalog of all the free shows, all of the subscriber shows, and all of the Enigmas specials. Yeah, you realize now where all the good stuff has been all along, and you've got a lot of catching up to do. Years and years and years that have accumulated there in our Hall of Records here in the bunker below Graylian Manor. So, indeed glad to have all of you aboard, and of course those of you who are now considering signing up. In light of everything you've heard, it's just $7 a month, or $77 a year. That gets you full access to all of the shows. And you know, I'm interested at the moment, all you ex-subscribers out there, I'd love to hear from some of you. With the popularity of things like Patreon, I'm now sort of considering whether, in addition to the way that we allow people to subscribe right there on the website, if some people might be more inclined to become subscribers if it were available through services like Patreon. That's definitely something I might be willing to explore. I'd love to hear from you guys about that or anything else that may be on your mind. If you've got emails that you'd like to send along with insights about the programs and what have you, I always like to hear from you guys. You can write to me at info@micahhanks.com. Please remember, it's almost impossible these days for me to answer all the emails that are coming in from the listenership. I do try to read everything, and when time allows, I will respond. So thanks to all of you who send along show notes, stories. Mark Brady, of course, has been doing that for years. You can send along stories that you find that you might like to hear me discuss here on the Micah Hanks Program, show topics, feedback, and what have you. We love to hear from you. And with that, it's about time for us to get back into this conversation. You know, it's obvious that the ancient Egyptians were quite the chemists in their own right. And this is definitely an interest that William R. Corliss had, and this week we're featuring a lot of entries from his catalog on archaeological anomalies, mostly comprising small artifacts or technological processes, but nonetheless those of an anomalous character. And indeed, as we're going to see, some of these may have actually contributed to some bigger mysteries about the ancient world. But again, coming back to the chemistry of the ancient world, we find clues about the level of technology and the knowledge that the ancient Egyptians had in very unlikely places. And keep in mind, as I mentioned earlier, going forward, you're going to notice that often when we look at the seemingly innocuous discoveries of the ancient world, sometimes clues about bigger mysteries emerge. Another good example that Corliss gives us involves how the ancient Egyptians applied cosmetics to themselves. Right? We see this often in the imagery in the various temples. We also see this carved into the likenesses of the ancient Egyptians themselves as featured on their sarcophagi. Sometimes this is further evidenced by the mummies that actually are within those sarcophagi. But as Corliss tells us, their cosmetic powders dating from 2000 BC have been exceptionally well preserved in their original vials made of alabaster, ceramics, and wood. However, a team of French chemists led by P. Walter was not surprised when their analyses of these powders found them to contain crushed galena and sericite. These are essentially two kinds of ores of lead. Now, that alone may not seem so strange, but as you, dear listener, no doubt had expected, this gets better. Because the same team of French researchers also found that in their analyses of these powders, They also found chemical compounds that are very rare in nature. These are known as laurionite and also phosgenite. According to Corliss, these compounds, he said, are so rare in nature that the Egyptian powders must be artificial. According to P. Walter's own notes, he says, taken together, these results indicate that the laurionite and phosgenite must have been synthesized in ancient Egypt using wet chemistry. The Egyptians manufactured artificial lead-based compounds and added them to the cosmetic product. The underlying chemical reactions, he said, are simple, but the whole process, including many repetitive operations, must have been quite difficult to achieve. Now, of course, this discovery in itself is quite fascinating. The idea that there was a much more sophisticated knowledge of wet chemistry that the ancient Egyptians possessed than we would expect to have found in the ancient world, I mean, that is fascinating unto itself. But here again, when we see the bigger picture, okay, so the ancient Egyptians were really good at chemistry. Well, then what else might they have been good at? How else might they have applied that? That's where things start to get really interesting. And this actually points to a possible solution to one of the great enduring mysteries of ancient Egypt and, in fact, the entire ancient world. And yes, that involves the construction of the pyramids. But some may be thinking, well now, what does chemistry have to do with how the pyramids were built? Well, you may be surprised. In fact, I want to refer to an article at the website of the National Science Foundation titled "The Surprising Truth Behind the Construction of the Great Pyramids." This article details the work of Professor Michael Barsoom, and it dates back to 2007. But as they quote him here in the article, he says, "This is not my day job." So begins National Science Foundation-supported researcher Michael Barsoom as he recounts his foray into the mysteries of the Great Pyramids of Egypt. As a well-respected researcher in the field of ceramics, Barsoom never expected his career to take him down a path of history, archaeology, and political science, with materials research mixed in. As a distinguished professor in the Department of Materials Science and Engineering at Drexel University, his daily routine consists mainly of teaching students about ceramics, or performing research on a new class of materials, the so-called Max phases, that he and his colleagues discovered back in the 1990s. These modern ceramics are machinable, thermal shock resistant, and are better conductors of heat and electricity than many metals, making the new materials potential candidates for use in nuclear power plants, the automotive industry, jet engines, and a range of other high-demand systems. But Barsoom then received an unexpected phone call from Michael Carroll, a friend of a retired colleague of Barsoom, who called to chat with the Egyptian-born professor about how much he knew of the mysteries surrounding the building of the Great Pyramids of Giza, the only structures remaining of the seven wonders of the ancient world. The widely accepted theory that the pyramids were crafted of carved-out giant limestone blocks that workers carried up ramps had not only been embraced by everyone, but, as important, had quite a number of holes. Well, as the caller would go on to tell Professor Barsoom on this particular phone call, the mysteries of how the pyramids were built had actually been solved by none other than Joseph Davidovits, director of the Geopolymer Institute in St. Quentin, France, and this more than two decades ago. Davidovits claimed that the stones of the pyramids were actually made of a very early form of concrete, and this created from a mixture of limestone, clay, lime, and water. So what did Barsoom think about this? His friend calls him and says, "Yeah, this French chemist, he found out that they're just concrete. That's how they built the pyramids." Well, Barsoom starts laughing. He thought it was a joke. According to the article here, if the pyramids were indeed cast, he says, somebody should have proven it beyond a doubt by now. Now, before we proceed, I want to back up here for a moment and note that by the time that Professor Barsoom received this phone call, as was noted earlier in this article, the French researcher in question, Joseph Davidovits, had already not only presented this theory, but he had also demonstrated that, in fact, a mixture of limestone, clay, lime, and water can be used to create slabs almost identical to those found in the construction of the pyramid, and almost identical, in fact, to the actual limestone harvested from the Mokum formation there at Giza, where the pyramids have been built. It would be one thing if this was completely rampant speculation on part of Davidovits, but to his credit, he has actually demonstrated not only could this have been done, it can be done, I have done it, and I'll show you And if you go online and you do searches online for Joseph Davidovits geopolymer pyramids, you will be able to find a video on YouTube where he clearly demonstrates how this is done. And indeed, the results are quite impressive. But now with that in mind, I'll return to the National Science Foundation article from 2007. Because, of course, Barsoom was laughing because he said, if indeed the pyramids had been built using similar methods, that should easily have been proven because in this day and age, a few hours of electron microscopy would settle that debate. And so naturally, Barsoom figured that somebody had conducted analysis of this sort. But of course, any good scientist worth his salt, or maybe in this case, worth his limestone, knows never to assume, right? We know where that gets us. And this is what launched him on what Barsoom initially thought might take a couple of hours, but ended up being a 5-year odyssey. He said, a year and a half later, after extensive scanning electron microscope observations and other testing, Barsoom and his research group finally began to draw some conclusions about the pyramids. And let me tell you, what they found may surprise you. Indeed, if this is what it appears to be, it very well may be one of the most significant attempts at chipping away at this mystery in stone that has endured now for thousands of years. And we will delve into this more deeply ourselves when we return right here on the Micah Hanks Program. Would have ever guessed that clues to the construction of the ancient pyramids at Giza might be found under a microscope. Welcome back. It is the Micah Hanks Program. And where we left off, we were looking at the research of Professor Barsoom, a man who initially laughed when first confronted with the notion that perhaps rather than built, portions of the pyramids might have been poured. As the NSF.gov website states, Barsoom and his research group finally began to draw some conclusions about the pyramid, and this after about a year and a half of extensive scanning with electron microscopes. And here's what they found. As it turns out, the tiniest structures that Barsoom and others were able to observe in the samples from pyramid casing stones that they analyzed was very much to their surprise consistent with a reconstituted limestone. In other words, a kind of cement. As the article here notes, the cement binding the limestone aggregate was either silicon dioxide, the building block of quartz, or a calcium and magnesium-rich silicate material. The stones also had a high water content, which was unusual because, of course, the normally dry, natural limestone found on the Giza Plateau doesn't generally retain a whole lot of water. And the cementing phases in both the inner and outer casing stones they found were amorphous. That means, in other words, their atoms weren't arranged in a regular and periodic array. Sedimentary rocks, of course, like limestone, are seldom, if ever, amorphous. So why, then, would these stone samples appear to possess these qualities? The sample chemistries the researchers found do not exist anywhere in nature. And that observation led Barsoom to a rather strange conclusion. Therefore, he said, it's very improbable that the outer and inner casing stones that we examined were chiseled from a natural limestone block. Let that sink in for a moment. The article continues, more startlingly, Barsoom and another of his graduate students, Aaron Sakalich, recently discovered the presence of silicon dioxide nanoscale spheres with diameters of only billionths of a meter across in one of the samples. This discovery further confirms that these blocks are not natural limestone. Now, just imagine what's going on here. Davidovich, when he initially said, look, you can actually make a kind of concrete from materials that the ancient Egyptians absolutely would have had available to them. And not only does this look almost identical to the natural limestone that is harvested from that formation, the Mokum Formation there, but also this would have allowed the easier transport and presumably also the easier construction of the Great Pyramids themselves. This could be a key to understanding certain aspects of the construction of these monuments. And furthermore, Davidovits was able to actually demonstrate how it was done. It wasn't just rampant speculation. He showed it could be done. You would think this would be an incredible discovery, but of course, how was this met by the Egyptology community? We know how they built the pyramids. Question, how sure are you that you know how they built the pyramids? So, decades later, this same information is brought to the attention of a materials scientist who laughs, as any good scientist would, right? I can't blame him, though. And just like we said at the very beginning of this discussion, right, there are many scientists who don't go there when it comes to topics like this because they know that politically and otherwise, it will not bode well for them if they get involved in these kinds of studies. But Barsoom said, well, you know, my interest is piqued enough that I'm willing to at least try this kind of analysis myself just because I haven't seen anybody else doing it. And when he conducts the analysis, lo and behold, what he finds under a microscope is consistent with what guys like Davidovits have been saying. Not only can it be done, but there's even some evidence of it. And yet, despite the accumulation of scientific data that seems to support this possibility, many in the Egyptological community are still resistant to the notion. I'll return to the National Science Foundation article here from 2007 briefly, where they go on to note, at the end of their most recent paper supporting these findings, the researchers reflect that it is, quote, ironic, sublime, and truly humbling that this 4,500-year-old limestone is so true to the original that it has misled generations of Egyptologists and geologists. And, quote, because the ancient Egyptians were the original, albeit unknowing, nanotechnologists. Now, you may have thought I was exaggerating when I referred earlier to the advanced technology of ancient civilizations, and the seemingly anomalous archaeology that seems to support the fact that ancient civilizations like the Egyptians possessed technology like this. They may not have seen it this way, nor had they known, in modern parlance, what it was that they were dealing with, but they had indeed probably stumbled upon processes that relied on modern chemistry, and yes, of course, which were tantamount to nanotechnology as we would define it today. As the NSF.gov article here states, as if the scientific evidence isn't enough, Barsoom has pointed out a number of common sense reasons why the pyramids were not likely constructed entirely of chiseled limestone blocks. But keep in mind, my understanding is that his perspective is not that the entire building, right, the entire Great Pyramid of Giza was poured into place like this, but rather that in some instances, this technology would account for how especially some of those blocks were placed in the more precarious positions. But returning again to the article here, they note, Egyptologists are consistently confronted by unanswered questions. How is it possible that some of the blocks are so perfectly matched that not even a human hair can be inserted between them? Why, despite the existence of millions of tons of stone, carved presumably with copper chisels, has not one copper chisel ever been found on the Giza Plateau? You know, there's an engineer by the name of Christopher Dunn. And in books of his like The Giza Power Plant, as the name entails, he actually supposes that these were technological devices, not just monuments. Now, in my opinion, I think it would be really interesting to talk with Christopher Dunn sometime, although I think some of his theories go a little too far out, to my liking at least, into the realm of speculation. But I've heard on many instances Christopher Dunn point out, correctly I think, that when you look at the, again, space-age technology, in his mind, you know, space-age accuracy, that we find in terms of the level, flat features on many of the carved surfaces in ancient Egypt, to suppose, like former Antiquities Minister Zahi Hawass and others have claimed it was done, to suppose that they used round hunks of granite and that they bashed this stone into these shapes, But the mechanisms that they used were so crude, and yet they could produce such seemingly perfect structures. I think that that makes so little sense that it almost undermines the incredible ingenuity that seems evident in structures of this magnificent quality and magnitude. Now, as the NSF.gov article notes, although Barsoom's research has not answered all of the questions about ancient Egypt, his work provides insight into some key questions. For example, it is now more likely than not that the tops of the pyramids, at least, are cast, as it would have been increasingly difficult to drag the stones to the summit. You remember a few weeks back we did an episode about the mystery of the construction of the pyramids. We looked at ancient accounts from Herodotus to Manetho and others, and we tried to find clues about how the pyramids might have been constructed. Even Herodotus talked about there being a machine that was used to hoist stones into place. But modern Egyptologists say that ramps were used. Indeed, that probably did work up to a point, but the taller the pyramid gets, you have to take into consideration how much, for instance, earth has to be moved into place in constructing the ramps just to be able to get the blocks to the top of the pyramid. It begins to actually be a more cumbersome task building the ramp than it is in actually constructing the pyramid itself. And then, of course, there are the lingering questions like, where did all that fill dirt go after they were done? Where is the evidence of where it was quarried from and then returned to? Where is any evidence that this mechanism for building the pyramids is indeed what was actually done? The simple answer is there is none. We don't really know. This idea that I'm outlining, which of course has been proposed by Egyptologists for decades and championed as the method of construction of the pyramids in many circles, it is, in fact, primarily speculation. Now, of course, there is a lot that we know about the construction of the pyramids. There are clues that are provided in the actual texts left to us by the ancient Egyptians. The idea of dampening sand to ease the passage of large blocks across the sand, that is indeed probably very likely to me, evidence that there were large stones that were being moved. And indeed, the Egyptians had a pretty good idea of how to wet that sand and to offer that lubrication to help move those blocks. But when we look beyond just the construction of the pyramids, and we look beyond just Egyptology, in fact, and we look at their apparent capabilities in terms of chemistry, the Egyptians were indeed quite the chemists of their era, and it therefore does not surprise me in the least that these people were, frankly, quite brilliant. They were quite the experimentalists. And given the fact that it would have been some very simple resources available to them, I would not be in the least bit surprised at the notion of ancient Egyptians experimenting with what they had, making unique discoveries, and then putting that to use in magnificent ways that have indeed stood the test of time. A final quote here from the NSF.gov article. They quote Barsoom, "How energy-intensive and or complicated can a 4,500-year-old technology really be?" The answer, he says, is not very. The basic raw materials used for this early form of concrete, limestone, lime, and diatomaceous earth, can be found virtually anywhere in the world. Now, that's an important point. He goes on to say, replicating this method of construction would be cost-effective, long-lasting, and much more environmentally friendly than the current building material of choice. Portland cement that alone pumps roughly 6 billion tons of CO2 annually into the atmosphere when it's manufactured. Indeed, he says, looking to the past, we might actually learn something about more sustainable, environmentally friendly building in the future. And in fact, this wouldn't be the first time that somebody said looking at ancient technologies and the ways the ancients lived their lives might actually help us improve our lives today and live better, more sustainable lives, if anything. But of course, as prolific as these kinds of materials are anywhere in the world, should we be looking at other ancient monuments and asking similar questions? Are geopolymers something that might have been used elsewhere in the world? We'll look at that as we wrap things up right here on the Micah Hanks Program. Welcome back. The idea of pouring pyramids remains a fairly controversial idea. And even I would hesitate to be all in on the notion that, well, every ancient monument must therefore be the result of geopolymers. If indeed one culture figured out how to do this, that's not necessarily true. But at the website geopolymer.org, where Davidovits has laid out the case for his theory over the years, he addresses a number of questions about this theory, one being, of course, well, if there's stone everywhere, what's the use in making concrete? But of course, the obvious answer to this one comes if we look at how difficult it is to make a monument the size of the Giza pyramids. And in fact, we can apply the same logic to many other ancient sites around the world, the Mesoamerican pyramids, any number of potential examples. But again, I doubt that this was probably what they did in all cases. In fact, even with the pyramids, what the evidence seems to suggest is that there were indeed large limestone blocks used in many instances. But we think about how long it took the pyramids to be built. And this may offer another clue, because again, as they begin building the pyramids, they think, well, you know, fewer and fewer blocks are going to be needed the higher up we get. So it may not be all that complex, but then about halfway up that structure, when you realize how long it's going to take to get to the peak point and how difficult it's getting to hoist those blocks up the sides of this thing and get them into place, yeah, after a while you begin to think, you know, maybe there's going to be an easier way that we can complete this structure. As the old saying goes, necessity is the mother of invention. And to me, it makes sense that it could have been the case that the idea for building the pyramids, and in fact, the inauguration of the construction progress, may have preceded the discovery that what we would recognize as concrete today could be created, and that could ease the construction process. In other words, it could be that once the process was underway, the construction process of the pyramids, that's when the builders realized how difficult this would be, and that led to the innovation, which is an interesting way of thinking about this. Although I will point out that Davidovits, based on his observations of what he thinks was likely there on the Giza Plateau, he has extended this to other parts of the world and says that he thinks indeed that many ancient monuments in other parts of the world also were built in this way. He points to ancient sites like Tiwanaku and others and says indeed, these, in my opinion, were probably also built through the knowledge the ancients had of the use of geopolymers. Now, that's an interesting perspective. Again, one would assume that, like Barsoom did with his samples of the casing stones from the pyramid, modern analysis would help us solve that mystery, well, at least, if not in a couple of months, maybe a year and a half. If we recall, it took Dr. Barsoom much longer than he had thought it would. But again, he also laughed when he first was presented with the idea and said, surely somebody has figured this out already. I'm sure a lot of scientific discoveries are made in that way. Somebody assumes, well, somebody else must have done that already, so I'm not going to go look into it. Only when somebody finally comes along and says, you know, I don't think anybody has ever resolved this question or solved that mystery or made that discovery. Only then does science really advance. So, all you material scientists out there listening to the program, that's something to consider. Maybe we can conduct similar analyses at other ancient sites around the world and see whether indeed we find similar things at these ancient sites with samples from those structures. But that would lead to some very interesting questions, wouldn't it? If other ancient cultures had been in the possession of knowledge that would have allowed them to pour these structures effectively, rather than to hew this from rough stone and then hoist those stone blocks into place, which of course remains the conventional archaeological model, and in many cases is probably the most likely construction method, I would maintain. But if indeed there were others in other parts of the world who knew about the geopolymer principle, there's an interesting question that comes out of this, because this could only go one of two ways, right? Either multiple ancient cultures stumbled upon this technology, which had remained unknown to modern humans for thousands of years, and it was independently discovered by multiple groups in various parts of the world who had never had any contact with one another. Or perhaps indeed, at some point along the way, that technology, the knowledge of this process, was shared between cultures. And again, that's a big no-no. in modern archaeology to suppose that there was indeed significant amounts of pre-Columbian contact between different groups around the world, because of course what that implies is that not only did the ancient people of long ago possess watercraft technology that helped them get around, but indeed there may have been multiple different migration routes, multiple different settlements in various parts of the world, and then we'd have to lend credence, possibly, to those long discredited ideas, those folk tales, those fables that people in, for instance, parts of South America, when the conquistadors first arrived, used to tell. And this, of course, before those conquistadors completely destroyed every vestige of their cultures, their histories, their calendrical systems, their mathematics, their language, before they were banned from worshiping their old gods in accordance with the new religion of the arriving conquerors. Yes, before everything that they had, including their homes and, of course, all their belief systems, were destroyed, they told stories about earlier arrivals. In fact, when Hernan Cortes first showed up on the scene, did they not mistake him for someone they recognized, this Quetzalcoatl, the feathered serpent? A little further south, according to other legends, he was known as Viracocha. And you hear these stories about people who came long, long ago and that they met the indigenous inhabitants. In fact, if we go far enough back in world cultures and traditions, some of those stories of people arriving from other worlds may have been the original arrivals. And this, of course, like the idea of the Bering Land Bridge and people coming over, migrating from Asia into the New World, kind of brings us full circle. It provides a bridge back to where science and what we might call conventional archaeology has left off. You know, we can look back and we can use the archaeological process to reveal a lot of answers about the ancient way of life, where people came from, and the things that they knew. But I think that there are also some instances where we completely fail to give credit to the ancient people and their way of life, and we seem to have this almost bizarre aversion to affording them any possibility that they had the kind of ingenuity that modern humans have, when in fact they were anatomically modern humans. They were as capable, as intelligent as you or I. Why do we necessarily have to be so averse to the idea that ancient people did indeed possess technologies which may be unexpected, maybe not quite like technology as we recognize it today, but technologies which nonetheless are surprising in their advancement and well, well ahead of their time? A little food for thought, my friends, and of course, as always, for ex-subscribers, there will be some additional discussion about archaeological anomalies of this sort, but I hope you've enjoyed this discussion on the Maine Public Podcast. And as always, thanks to all of you for being here and being along for the ride. I remain yours truly, Micah Hanks. It is always my pleasure to bring you thoughts and insights on topics like these. You can find out more about my work at MicahHanks.com. And of course, email me, info@MicahHanks.com. Follow me on Twitter @MicahHanks. And next time, of course, we will return right here on the Micah Hanks program. In the meantime, all of you stay strange out there.
Of households that start the year with Peloton are still active a year later.
92% because of a bike?
Not just bikes. We also make treadmills and rowers.
Oh, let me guess, for elite athletes only, right?
Nope. It doesn't matter if you're an avid exerciser or new to working out. Peloton can help you achieve your fitness goals. 92% stick with it. So can you. Try Peloton bikes, tread, or row risk-free with a 30-day home trial. New members only. Not available in remote locations. See additional terms at onepeloton.com/home-trial.